Before we start.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Seth Perler with TFOS, the Executive Function Online Summit. And I'm here today with Stuart Shanker, who's sitting out in the woods up in Canada on a little island somewhere. Stuart Shanker is a distinguished research professor in psychology and philosophy. And his focus professionally is on what's called self-reg or self-regulation, which obviously is completely tied into executive function, but we're going to look into that today. And what Stuart does is he teaches parents and teachers how to do self-reg, how to do self-regulation through the Merit Center. And today we're going to look into what is self-regulation and how does it impact your child's executive function and what can you do about it. So how are you doing today?
That was a great intro. I think you said everything I was going to say.
Good. Cool. Well, let's start off, Stuart, with tell us a little bit about who you are personally, where you're at, and what you're into outside of work.
Well, I'm about as Canadian as you get. So that means I play hockey, I ski, I snowshoe. And like Seth said, I live on an island and I'm pretty much what you can see right now, those trees. That's kind of what I live in 24/7. So I'm a happy guy. I got two wonderful kids and a wonderful wife. And I've also got, if you're interested, I've got about 50 chickens because we run a little hobby farm. And my daughter is doing a little experiment. She started with two bunnies. We've now lost count. So we're surrounded by animals too.
Awesome. Cool. So totally into nature and animals.
Yes. Yes.
I can relate to that. And you like rock and roll too, we were talking about before we started here.
Yeah, if my kids were here, they would tell you how I punish them by forcing them to listen to decent music, which for me is Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. That's where it starts.
All right, cool. And how about your professional background? You want to tell us a little bit more about who you are professionally and how you got to where you're at?
So I was a scholarship kid. I went to a Canadian university and they sent me off to Oxford. And I was at Oxford University for 10 years and did a bunch of degrees there. And really all of my background in self-regulation was in the scientific side. We'll get into that a little bit today. And then when I came back to Canada, I taught in two faculties, psychology and philosophy, teaching self-regulation. And then we opened up a center, the Merit Center. And this is now, first of all, we operate everywhere in Canada. It's exploded. And now it's going international. We're just setting up an international umbrella. We're hoping, to give you a real concise definition, what's the goal of self-reg? It's to create a just society. That's what we're all about. And we think we're actually starting to get there.
And why do you think it's exploded so much?
I think it's really, in economics, they talk about demand creating supply. I think that we are an incredibly overstressed culture.
And when you say we, do you mean Canada or the West? Well, or
I mean the world. So I've done everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, I see all the signs of being overstressed. But I have to say to you, Seth, I think the U.S. may just about be winning that particular sweepstakes right now. The U.S. is incredibly overstressed at the moment. And the big thing about self-reg is it really helps us understand the why. It helps us figure out what stresses are that we wouldn't even imagine were. But most important of all, it tells us what to do. It gives us practical steps for managing the stress in our lives. And I think that's why I took off.
And when you started studying this stuff many years ago, did you call it self-reg at the time or where did that term come from?
No. Self-regulation, that term is real old. That term actually goes back to the middle of the 19th century. And the guys I studied were, the big guy here is an American called Walter Bradford Cannon. And he really created the science of self-regulation in the 1920s. But then what happened was the term got picked up. And I want your parents to understand, don't go look up self-regulation on Google. There are 447 different definitions of self-regulation. So we really stick to the original one, the one that Cannon gave in 1920. And that definition is, how do you manage stress? And it's an incredibly powerful question. And the method itself is pretty good too.
Cool. Yeah. And we don't obviously teach formally, no, at least in schools, kids how to manage stress.
No, we don't. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to say at the outset today is I went through your list of presenters and you've got a wonderful summit. I mean, these are, if I was going to do a who's who of executive function instructors, you've got them. Now, with self-regulation, what we're looking at is something that's a little bit prior. It's like a foundation for executive function coaching. And really what we find is that once we can start to get into what's called growth-promoting self-regulation, good self-regulation, it makes anything you're going to do, you parents are going to do with these presenters, that much more powerful, that much more effective. But when a kid is overstressed, they really have a hard time processing what these various experts are saying. So we want to get them through self-reg into the state where they really maximize from this summit.
Awesome. I was, so one of the coolest things about the summit is that each of the speakers essentially is saying a lot of the very same core concepts,
yeah,
just with a different veneer.
Yeah.
And what's so cool about that is that I think when parents can sit here and watch 20 people who are immersed in this world of serving, yeah, kids on this level say the exact same things, it really affirms, okay, these are the things that we do. So I want to ask you a follow-up with this.
Yeah.
I had one of the speakers, they said that they use the term safe and social brain and then the fight, flight, and freeze.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
That when we're in the safe and social, that's a place where we can execute. And then when we're in the fight, flight, or freeze, we have to learn how to work with that. And she went from a very somatic perspective. But
that's good, though. That's real good.
It's super aligned, huh?
So we're gonna introduce, in our session today, we're going to introduce yet another level. We're going to have three brains, not just two. And that's kind of cool.
Cool. I'm super excited to nerd out on that with you because I love models and I love just the overlap. And
I'm going to make you happy then.
That we can provide people with like solutions that they can digest in their mind. So why does this matter to you? How did you even start getting into this?
So that question, I could give you a scientific answer, but I'll give you the real answer. I was 17 years old, and my best friend was one of the smartest guys I'd ever met. And he got into trouble. He started getting into trouble when he was about 15. And then when he was 17, he was sent to, we have youth detention centers. And then when he was 18, he actually went to prison. And this was a guy who he was enormously talented and clever and overstressed, really, really overstressed. Family had a lot of stress. And when I was 17 and he was taken into custody, I stayed up all night that night and I wrote a manifesto. And what I said was, I was devastated because I kind of knew that his life had just really hit the rocks. And I didn't want that to happen to any kid. So in my manifesto, I said I was going to study whatever I could so that we never lose a kid this way. And that's essentially why I ended up going to Oxford. And then when I came back here, I was mentored in psychiatry by Dr. Stanley Greenspan. And Stan was, in my opinion, the greatest child psychiatrist of the 20th century. And all along, what we were after was, we don't want to lose a kid, not any kid, not for any reason. But we needed skills and we needed knowledge to put that into practice.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm similarly, like, it was driven by the experiences that I had.
Yeah.
To really want to serve in this capacity.
I think you need the experience to have the passion.
Yeah. And so we have all these parents from all over the place watching this and trying to understand, in the terms that we're using in the summit, executive function. So how do you define executive function, like in a sentence? And then can you unpack that a little bit for us?
So what I want to do is I really want to define self-regulation as the sort of it's the foundation which executive functions, things like, you know, paying attention, how you can sequence your thinking. We really want to have a strong foundation for those skills, for those executives function skills. So what we look at is we want to look at what is the support, what makes it possible for a kid to master, to acquire executive function skills, especially those kids that are struggling. So our definition here, we're lucky because the definition of what is self-regulation takes about 7 words. Self-regulation is how you manage stress, and that's what it is. Okay, right. That's the short version. Now I need a chance to go into the longer version.
Awesome. Perfect. Yeah, we'll dive right in the longer version right now as we start to unpack this next part of the talk in terms of diving into the problem. And okay. When you're working with a lot of parents and teachers, and when you're working with somebody new who really is very new to your work, doesn't know about your approach, and they're starting at point A.
Yeah.
And you want to get them to point B where they have the tools that you like to empower people with, and somebody's really turned a corner. What does point A look like for the parents watching, and what does point B look like?
So if I was to describe the single biggest misconception we see out there, and every parent that we work with at point A has this misconception, they hear me say something like, you know, talking about self-regulation, and they say, oh, well, you know, geez, I'd love for my kid to learn how to do that. But the truth is, every single child self-regulates. We all self-regulate. A kid starts self-regulating the second they're born. But here's a problem. The problem is you can self-regulate in a way that we call maladaptive. A maladaptive way of self-regulating is it handles the stress in the moment, but it gets more stress down the road. And this is the big problem with addiction, right? Addiction is actually a way of self-regulating, but it's very maladaptive. So what we want to do with kids that are having problems with executive functions, we see 100% of these kids hooked on maladaptive ways of self-regulating. I'll explain what that means in 1 second, okay? So we want to shift them. We want to shift them into what we call growth-promoting ways of self-regulation. So let me give you an example just to explain what this is all about. The brain, you know, one of the problems that parents have is they hear a word like managing stress, and right away, if you ask parents, well, what do you think stress means? They'll talk about things like, you know, well, the stress of exams or the stress of, you know, competition. But when scientists talk about stress, they actually mean something a little different. When the scientist uses the word, and this is Cannon, who Walter Cannon was the guy who came up with this, a stress is anything that requires us to burn energy in order to remain stable, in order to remain functioning. So he gives an example, and his example is cold. Cold weather is a stress. In fact, for scientists, it's the best example of what a stress is. Because if you get cold, the problem is the brain is designed to keep our internal body temperature at 98.6 degrees. And if you get cold, if it's cold outside, or if it's really hot, same argument, then what happens is the brain triggers a whole bunch of automatic reactions that generate heat. So you start to shiver, you start to, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up. Now, if you take something like shivering is very expensive. And that's what we want parents to think about today, that too much stress is very expensive. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that a kid, if they're cold, they burn, and they have to shiver to stay warm, they burn around 7 calories per minute just shivering. So what we can do is we can self-regulate to reduce the amount of energy we burn. What does that mean? Well, we can put on a coat. We can put on a hat. These are all really good ways of reducing how hard the brain has to work. Or we could do something stupid.
So we're making it less expensive.
Exactly right. Or we can do something stupid. Now, one time I was skiing in Austria and I was really cold. It was at the top of the mountain. It was bloody cold. And I'm with a bunch of Austrians and they said to me, oh, well, when we get cold, we drink Jägerte. So I never drunk Jägerte. I didn't even know what it was. And I'm not a drinker. But I had a glass of it. And then they gave one to my wife. And she's not a drinker, so she slipped me hers. So I had 2 Jägertes. And I don't know what the alcoholic content is. It's really high. We were talking like 50%. So I was instantly, let's say, quasi-drunk. And the next thing I knew, I was skiing down a mountain on one ski, laughing heroic. You know, I thought it was all hilarious. And somehow made it to the bottom. And then what happened was very interesting. So they took me, my wife took me back to the place we were staying, and I shivered uncontrollably for a couple of hours. And that's a great example of maladaptive, because the Jägerte warmed me up for a couple of minutes, but then down the road, I was 10 times colder than I would have been. Plus, you had my impaired judgment. So the question we ask ourselves is, what are the kinds of maladaptive ways that kids are self-regulating today? What are the most common ones? You want to take a shot at that? What would you say are the most common ways of maladaptive self-regulation?
Well, one thing, just to connect the dot, it sounds like it ended up being more expensive.
Exactly. Exactly. That's great.
But it didn't seem like it. And that's what
maladaptive.
I love these analogies.
That's great. That's great.
Very digestible.
What are kids doing that's maladaptive?
Well, I would think a lot of the gaming and social
okay,
media.
Okay, let's stop right there. So if I had to pick my number one, that's it. Okay, so Seth's right on the money here. So what's the problem with gaming? Well, it's not the problem with gaming per se. You can play a game, it's not going to hurt you. The problem is if a kid is dealing with his stress by excessive gaming.
Right, so in the moment, it's helping to self-regulate.
Right.
But there's costs.
And down the road, what happened? No, so mom and dad, ask yourself, when you finally turned off the game, how is your kid? Was he nice and calm? Sweet? Did he want to help out around the house? I don't think so. Because we talked to an awful lot of parents. And it turns out that if that kid's been on gaming excessively, so let's say a couple of hours, several hours, he's a real handful when you get him off the game. So then we want to ask ourselves, okay, I compared that. So Seth has nailed what we mean by maladaptive. Now let's do the same and nail growth promoting. So growth promoting self-regulation is something that helps us deal with the stress in the moment and creates even more energy, is restorative down the road. So what would be a great, Seth, can I turn on you again? What's a good growth promoting self-regulation?
Well, for me, going on a hike.
Okay, fabulous. Okay, so now I thought Seth was going to give us a different answer. I thought Seth was going to turn around and look at his wall because music is wonderful.
Yeah.
But going on a hike, so now we have this terrific work that John Rady has done, and we know that when you exercise, and by the way, it's the same for me, going on a hike or going for a run. We know that what that does is not only does it get rid of the tension that's built up, but it triggers something in the brain, a little neurochemical called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which makes us smarter, happier, gives us energy. So what we're looking for with kids, now this is important, Seth, there is no one size fits all. So every kid, what we have to figure out is, what does this kid enjoy? So we're going to experiment with kids. We're going to find those growth promoting modes of self-regulation that they enjoy. Is it cooking? Is it art? So with my daughter, when she's overstressed, she paints. You know, we want to find what that child wants and not say, okay, I'm going to go make my kid now go on a hike because some kids, it is not restorative. For some kids, especially kids, and this applies to a lot of EF kids with executive function problems, they may actually have problems with motor control. And so if we expose them to physical challenges when they're overstressed, they may become even more stressed. We see this with our bike program. So it's really a case of trial and error to figure out which is the one that is that leaves them calm, restored, and back to a sort of energy tension. You know, we're filling up their fuel tank with energy. That's, we're putting gas in the tank. That's what we're doing.
And to connect the dots back, so you said restorative three times.
Yeah.
And to connect the dots with what you were saying before, you're investing or you're getting a return on your investment. Rather than it costing you so much, you're actually filling the bucket with.
Seth, you're going to have to come work for us. No, that's really good. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. Now, at the very beginning, you had said something about that. You said the number one biggest mistake parents made, and I think you said it, but I didn't. I didn't hear it clearly. Can you tell us again what is that number one mistake that you see or misconception? I forget how you worded it.
So the biggest mistake that we see is there is a fundamental distinction between misbehavior and stress behavior. And the number one mistake we work with is parents who confuse a stress behavior as if it was misbehavior. And so they go into punishment mode or they get angry, they get irritated. But in fact, it was a very different mechanism. Now, to understand that does require a little bit of science. So you want to do a bit of science?
Let's do that. And let me tie this into something that I talk about a lot and I've been talking about pretty much everybody with, which is what I call, I just want to tie it in conceptually.
Yeah, go for it.
For everybody who's watching 20 of these presentations, I talk about iceberg theory, where we often see what's at the tip of the iceberg and we see what's beneath the iceberg. So right now we're going to explore, through Stuart's words, how do we look at, is that correct?
Seth, that's wonderful. And that's exactly what we're doing. Remember I said that we wanted, with self-regulation, we want to give that support to the executive function work, which is what we see above the surface. So we're trying to dig down below. And when we talk about
calling it misbehavior is staying surfacey.
Staying surface. And we're in a very fortunate position. You said something before that made me triggered a thought. One of the things parents should understand, Seth made the point that we've got, you know, all these different speakers that are making, roughly speaking, very similar points, raising very similar, using similar concepts. And the reason is we are living through one of the most exciting revolutions in science, neuroscience in particular, and physiology. And so over the last, since I was in graduate school, so over the last 40 years, our understanding of behavior has exploded. And what all of these experts are the reason why they're so powerful is because they are capitalizing on these scientific advances. So it's important that parents understand that this is, all of the things you're doing in your summit are science-based. These are discoveries that guys like me are trying to present in terms that parents can actually apply. And one of the big ones for us is in 1990, another American, a guy called Paul McLean, wrote a book called The Triune Brain. Now, I don't think parents want to read this because it's really written for specialists in neuroscience, but we can talk about his basic idea in terms that everybody can resonate with. And what he says is the human brain is actually three brains in one. One of them at the very base of the brain is what he called the reptilian brain. Seth referred to it before as a survival brain. This is an ancient brain that evolved about 300 million years ago. And it was designed for reptiles. So think about reptiles for a second. These are solitary creatures, non-social creatures. I live on my island. We have a turtle preserve, so I study the turtles. It's really interesting. The mom comes, lays her eggs, and she's gone. And 245 days later, the eggs hatch, and the little baby turtle climbs its way out, and it makes its way on its own. These are what are called singletons. So a solitary creature needs some very basic mechanisms for dealing with danger. And those mechanisms are fight, flight, and freeze. So in self-reg, we call this the brown brain, because when you look at brain images, these processes turn up as brown. They use brown because if you ever watch weather maps, when all hell breaks out, the map is brown. If it's an earthquake, it's brown.
So can I ask a little technical question right there? When they're looking at the imaging and they're seeing the brown, is it brown in the areas that are activated, or is it brown because it's drawing blood away from the other areas and that part looks brown?
It's brown in the areas that are activated. And the reason is that the guys who designed these systems used three colors that they took from weather maps. They used blue, red, and brown. So on a weather map, blue was used for bright, sunny, clear weather, red for stormy weather, and brown for all hell breaks out weather. And so they just used the same colors on the neural images because those are the ones we were familiar with. So, but having said that, your point is actually correct. So what Seth just said is enormously important. He said, so we had partial answer. Yes, it's brown because that's the convention, but it's also brown because it is drawing blood away from that blue brain, that thinking brain.
That's what I was going to ask. Then does the blue become lighter or?
So we had at my clinic, so we had an experimental clinic, and we used to, every single child that came into the clinic had a year of therapy. And these were kids that were really, really struggling with self-regulation. And when the kid was hyper aroused. Can I use that word? Hyper aroused. So really, you know, like everything's kind of going a little bit, not in fight or flight, just really hyper, really aroused. So when he was hyper aroused and you looked at his brain image, everything was red. That was the middle brain in McLean's theory. I'll explain it in one sec because it's important. When the kid calmed down, everything was blue. All you saw was blue. And when the kid had a meltdown and everything turned brown, that was the time to turn off the neuroimaging machine and just calm the child down. So the one I'm interested in here, okay, so you got this ancient brain designed for a solitary, non-social creature. So if a kid goes into fight or flight, they have regressed to a pre-social state. They don't see you. They don't hear you. They don't connect with you. They are regressing to this sort of primitive, very primitive state. Above that, McLean has what we call the red brain. So he called it the limbic system. Well, we'll just stick with that. And that brain was selected around 200 million years ago. I want to spend 1 second on this because it's enormously helpful for parents. The limbic system was designed for mammals. Mammals are social. The mother raises her babies. They live in groups. So you needed a brain that was designed for caregiving. You needed a brain that could distinguish between friend or foe. If that brain identified someone through their facial expression or their the sounds they were making as a potential threat, it sent a message down to that brown brain, and it goes into fight or flight.
So this is not safe. This is a threat.
This is a threat. And then you get fight or flight, a surge of adrenaline. Why is this so important for where you and I started just now? Because think about this now. you've got this brain, this mammalian brain, this limbic system, and it's really important. It's the source of love, of attachment. It's the source of people getting along together. We find in experiments, if we knock out the blue brain, we knock out the thinking brain, and the subject is playing some sort of competitive game, the competitors become more affiliative, more the cooperative. So the red brain is actually the source of cooperation. The blue brain can get in the way, which is not what we expect. So now here's what I want parents to think about. So you got this brain in us, this middle level brain, that's constantly scanning the environment. This brain is online 24/7. It is always online. It is always scanning the environment, looking for safety, looking for danger. If it spots danger, then it'll go into brown. So that means that this brain has its own kind of perception, because it's got to be perceiving, right? It's perceiving on its own, and it has its own way of communicating, because mammals communicate. So we refer to this as neuroception. Why am I spending time on this? Because I said to you at the outset, we want to distinguish between misbehavior and stress behavior. Stress behavior comes from this red brain. Stress behaviors are these mammalian impulses. Is this a threat? Should I be hypervigilant? It's always looking for these. And one of the shocking things about, one of the big discoveries that we made about kids with ADHD is they have a kindled hypervigilance. They are always looking for, they're always looking for danger. What was that noise? Okay. On top of this, so that one's 200 million years.
I think that's a really good point to notice too, is a lot of kids that I work with who struggle with executive function, a lot of them are diagnosed with ADHD. They're so interrelated. And it really reminds me of like a guard in a guard tower at a castle.
You got it.
One guard and he's always on lookout. That's
you
really
got
good.
It. You but got
you
it.
You don't need 50.
So that's exactly it. Okay. Now, above that, on top of that, there's a new brain. And this brain is the human brain. And this one's not very old. This one's only about 3 million years old. And this brain is really cool. So this brain thinks, this brain plans, it speaks language. Language is a new brain. We call it the neocortex. In self-reg, we call it the blue brain. So all these things, executive functions are blue brain. Executive functions, learning, you know, learning skills so you can order your thoughts, sequence your thoughts. These are blue brain functions.
So is that the most of the cortex?
Okay, so no, for us, what we're really interested in is this part here, the prefrontal cortex.
When it comes to self-reg?
When it comes to self-reg. We're really looking at prefrontal. It's the whole neocortex, everything that Seth did, and especially this part over the eyes. Okay, now here's where it gets real cool. Okay, misbehavior is blue brain. That means that the kid knew what he was doing. That kid chose to, let's say, lie. Lying is a classic blue brain misbehavior. The child is trying to get out of trouble. The child knows that what he's saying isn't true and is deliberately trying to get out of being punished. But that's very different from red brain. Red brain, the kid doesn't know. Red brain is below the surface of awareness. Red brain is this ancient brain. It's just reacting. It's like the watchtower, only it's not thinking, it's just reacting. It's based in something called the amygdala. And what it does is it reacts, and then it's unfortunately can shut down blue brain. So this is why stress behavior becomes so incredibly important, because suppose now, I'll give you an example, okay? I was called in they had a 13-year-old kid, and he had said some inappropriate things in class, blurted them out. This kind of blurting is a typical red brain behavior. And so they said to the kid that if he didn't get his act together, he would be expelled, basically, or suspended. And he said the classic, "I don't care." And every time they raised the stakes, he just kept on repeating, "I don't care, I don't care." But the principal who had taken over is a school that we work with closely. So he called me, and I live quite close to the school. And he said, "Can you pop over?" And so when I came in, the kid's face was, he was white as a ghost. We come back to that one second. I'll bet you Seth can explain why he was white. So he's white. His voice was shrill. And the vice principal kept on threatening him. And he kept on saying, "I don't care." And that made everybody even nuts. Okay, so here's a question for you, Seth. Why was his face white? That's a hard one.
Probably blood was being drawn away from places where it wasn't needed and being taken to places where he could protect his
safety. You are so good. You are so good at this. It's unbelievable. That's exactly it.
I've been geeking out on this stuff for years, but
no, but that's exactly the right answer. So mom and dad, you're going to be asking yourself, well, how do I know if it's a stress behavior or a misbehavior? Well, there's a good one right there. We can look at his face and see where, if it's gone pale, but we can do it even without looking at him, because the voice changes in stress behavior. If the pitch goes up, that means that his voice goes a little higher. So you can actually, every parent now is probably nodding their head, because now that they think about it, they say, "Oh yeah, I can be in the other room and know when my kid is overstressed just by his voice." Yes, you do know this. So now, if it's a stress behavior, what do I not want to do? Well, I sure don't want to yell at him. And I sure, because I want that blue brain online. And if he's done something bad and I need him to learn from this experience, or if he's not paying attention and I want him to learn how to pay attention, the first thing I got to do is I got to turn off what Seth called the watchtower guy. I got to turn off that alarm. So how do I do that? Well, it's not that hard. It really is not that hard. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to lower my voice. I'm not going to try to instruct. This is not the moment to instruct. I'm definitely not going to punish. I'm not going to send it. If I try to punish stress behavior, I'll send him into brown brain. So what I want to do is I want to bring that blue brain back online. And Seth told us how you do it. It's what that other expert said. That child has to feel safe. As soon as that child feels safe, the alarm turns off. He comes. Now, when he's safe, when he's calmed down again, now you can say stuff. Now he will process it. But if he's in red brain, then he will not process what you're saying. He doesn't mean, "I don't care." Really, all he's doing there is it's a primitive animal expression, and he just wants to get out.
Yep. That is his nervous system talking, not his.
Oh, fabulous. That's his. Okay, so here, what we want parents to learn is that there is a real big difference between misbehavior and stress behavior. There are signs when it's stress behavior. There are signs when it's misbehavior. And there are techniques, there are methods for turning off that alarm, bringing him back into balance. And now what we've got to figure out is a very interesting question. Typically, with kids that are having problems with executive functions, they have what's called a kindled alarm. And what that means is that their alarm's going off all the time. Their alarm's going off at the slightest little thing. In fact, part of a kindled alarm is it gets screwed up. It's a bit like we compare it to having a car alarm that keeps going off when a leaf lands on the hood of the car. So the child actually starts to misperceive.
I really like that analogy. The alarm goes off when a leaf hits the car. Yeah. Is that the same term as hyper aroused?
So the reason why that happens is because the kid is chronically hyper-aroused.
So their baseline is higher. And
you one got of
the
it.
Ways that I've
you got it.
Explained
you
this
got
over
it.
The years is that everybody has stress and anxiety throughout the day. If you stub your toe, you should look down, make sure it's not a real danger. Then you re-regulate yourself and you say, okay, it's just a rock. I'm good.
You got it.
You know, but when we're super aroused and for people who are experiencing that, which certainly was me as a kid, we have more frequent spikes, what I call spikes,
I love it.
Bigger spikes because we're starting from a higher baseline in the first place.
So that's as good an explanation as I've ever heard. Okay. And it's dead on. So that raises a very interesting question for parents now. So if what Seth and Stuart are saying is right, and we can begin to see that, yes, my kid is hyper aroused. By the way, when we look at hyper arousal, we actually look at it in terms of what's going on in the brain. So when Seth just used the term, these spikes, that's actually what we see in the brain. We see these constant spikes in the brain. So the question that you're going to be asking yourself, mom and dad, is, well, why is my kid hyper aroused? I mean, you know, we have a nice family home. My other kids aren't hyper-aroused. Why is he hyper-aroused? Why is she hyper-aroused? Kids will react to hyper-arousal in different ways. Some of them become very withdrawn, very anxious. This will be what Dr. Dan talked about. And some of them become very inattentive. Some of them become maybe a little bit aggressive. They all have different ways of responding. So our question now is, why? I'm beginning to suspect from what Stuart's saying, yeah, I think there's some hyperarousal. Why?
Can I interrupt you for?
You sure can.
And you can weave these in as you want. One thing is the word attunement. We've used this with other speakers. So when Stuart's talking about like noticing, for example, the flushness in the face, Carly Ray was talking about different biomarkers where you might notice difference in musculature or the vote.
Oh, she talked about that, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, if you're not, one thing Stuart's talking about is we want to bring to our awareness as the adults that these things are even going on, because a lot of times
we're not even
looking for it. So part of our work as adults is to be looking for these responses.
Can I give my response to the first part of what you just said?
Please, but can I say the second thing before I forget it?
Yeah.
The second thing was that you used the word meltdowns before.
Yes.
And I want to make it clear that meltdown, the association can often be that meltdown is an explosion of anger, but it can also be what you just mentioned, internal and not even visible if it's the type of kid that's withdrawn, which you just used that word. So if you can weave those.
Okay. So I'm going to weave right now. So I'm going to answer both the points that Seth just made. Okay. Yes. That's yes. Big yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, so now we brought mom and dad to the point where they're beginning to learn, and that's the whole point of this summit, right? So they're going to learn what these signs are, and it does take learning. Some kids are very complicated. They're complex. And that's where experts really are helpful. They open our eyes. We begin to see things like maybe we sort of were aware of it intuitively, but once we become consciously aware of it, two things happen that are enormously important. The one thing is that we can respond in a way that helps, but there's even something more fundamental. When I recognize that this is stress behavior and not misbehavior, my own anxiety as a parent instantly comes down. We get very anxious when we think our child is misbehaving. And the second we see that this is really a stress behavior, we've seen it thousands of times. The second we understand this, our own calmness returns. And now we are in the state where we can provide that kind of safe response that the child desperately needs in the moment. Okay, so I guess the last question I really wanted to look at is why. Why is this happening?
And do you use the word co-regulation?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, you want me to use it now?
It just seems we've had other speakers say that too, and it just seems like this is that when Seth, the adult's nervous system is
Seth. At the very end, could you bring me back to that?
Yep.
Because that's where I'd like to end.
Let me take a note. Yep.
Okay. So what has to happen next is parents need to really begin to deepen their understanding of stress, what stress is. Stress is not a bad thing. We need stress. Some stresses, so let me give you an example. What's a really good stress? Well, exercise. So weightlifting is a great example here. In weightlifting, you are stressing the muscles, but the result is the muscles get stronger. So the number one stress that we want children exposed to is school. Because school is a stress, learning is a stress, but it's a good stress. It's a stress that has all these positive benefits. We know this, but learning cannot occur. School will not be a success if my child is overstressed. If his stress is already high, then exposing him to the further stress of learning math is going to send him into red brain and possibly into fight or flight. Kids actually go into fight or flight now through math. Okay. So to help parents, so they can get off our website, they can get for free stress inventories. But the way these work basically is there are five major kinds of stress. And you have to know all five different kinds because we want parents to be stress detectives. And as a stress detective, your number one rule is it's never just one stress. It's always more than one, and usually it's all five domains. So one stress may strike you as, well, this is it. This is the one that stands out. And in my last book, in Self-Reg, if they get that book, and I hope they will, not because I want to sell books, but I think it helps. There's a story of a little girl, 13-year-old girl, that was having a meltdown because her mom bought her the wrong color sweatshirt that she wanted, wrong color hoodie. But there was actually five different kinds of stress going on with this child. And to help her, we have to look at all five. Okay, so what are the five kinds of stress? Number one, physical. Noise, visual noise, crowds. Every child is different. So temperature, smells. For some of the kids that we work with, the biggest stress that they had was odors. We had kids with executive function problems where the stress was being caused just by the number of students in the classroom. It was too much. So when we look at physical, we break it down. There's all kinds. Maybe it's food. Maybe it's the food they're eating. They're working too hard to process. Junk food is a huge physiological stress. One of the biggest stresses, and I won't talk about this today, but one of the biggest stresses on young children is pop. Pop is a stress. The sugar, the glucose is a stress. The brain has to work very hard to get rid of it. Okay, so you have to learn this stuff. The next domain is emotion stresses. And that's easy, right? So fear is a stress. Anger is a stress. And then above that is a very interesting one. And again, this is complicated, so I'll just mention it. It's cognitive stress. So what's a cognitive stress? Well, math. Math is a cognitive stress. And what that means is math makes big demands on our working memory. And when a child is having trouble with math, their whole body tenses up. If you look at them, you'll see their heart is working. There's lots and lots of stuff that we can say about this. But cognitive stress is unique. And it's extremely relevant to executive functions. Because quite often, the source of cognitive stress is a processing deficit. Can I use that word? They're born with something like let's just make this easy. Okay, so the kid finds math very stressful. But what we found is most of these kids have they have a problem with numerical processing, it's called. And the sad thing about this is, we know how to work with this. We know what to do to reduce the stress of math. We can do math, we can teach math in such a way that every kid has a joy doing it. And that's the key for all of this, right? Reducing them. And then above that is social stress. And social stress is number one for kids in school, because school is, you know, you've got to learn how to get along with other kids and how to follow rules. And then finally, we call pro-social stress. And pro-social stress is being moral, is being upright, is feeling empathy. Empathy is a stress. Dealing with someone else's distress. So long and the short of it is, when we work with kids, what we find, it is never, ever just one stress. Even if one sticks out at you, it's always more than one. And if the kid's having a lot of trouble, it's probably all five. Does that help?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. So I do have one clarification question. So basically, those are things that are going on under the tip of the iceberg. There's something impacting the kid.
Yep.
And there are these stressors. And there was physical, cognitive, emotional,
social,
and
pro-social.
And pro-social.
Getting along with others.
And earlier you were saying maladaptive and growth. What was
promoting?
Growth promoting. So on these five, are there both sides of the coin on each of these five?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
that was my clarification.
So maladapt. Okay. I don't think. Do you want me to give you examples? I think the way you just said is good.
Yeah. Yep. I think we got that. Yeah.
Okay. So so now, you know, this brings us kind of full circle now.
So the parent's a detective, or the teacher, I think you said detective?
Yeah, stress detectives. Okay, so now we're going to go full circle. And the full circle here is, okay, so I'm learning this stuff. It's a lot for me to absorb. Is there a method? Is there a way for me to actually have, you know, in our case, five basic steps to guide me through this process of getting my kid back into blue brain? Back into that thinking brain. What did you call it at the outset?
Safe and social.
Safe and social. So so we want, that's where we want the kid. And so what we've got to do is turn off the alarm. And okay, so there are five steps that we teach in self-reg to do this. And we call them the five R's. First one, step one, reframe. What does that mean? That means asking yourself before you react, is this misbehavior? Is this stress behavior? If it's stress behavior, I'm going to react a very different way than if it's misbehavior. If it's misbehavior, I'm going to try to teach, I'm going to try to model, whatever. But if it's stress behavior, I'm going to soothe, I'm going to calm. Okay.
So important. Can I interrupt you there?
Yes, please.
So important. So my work, when I start with a new client, a lot of my work is to get there in the first place.
Yes. So Seth, us too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Us too. Same thing. Step two.
So we have to have to reframe it. So as adults, stop for the watcher. So as adults, we have to, our default is probably going to be we grew up with.
Yes. Which
probably
love it.
Shape up, kid. You know, what's wrong with you? Whatever whatever messages we sort of grew up with, those are our defaults. But we have to shift away from that, reframe it. So the frame that we have around it is, this is misbehavior. And we have to reframe it and say, is this this or is this? We have to filter that. Okay.
And asking yourself why, what's going on here, is enough that you don't go back into that default mode. Just that little pause is all you need to stop this kind of cycle. It's real important today. It's important today because where we started, this is a very stressful time. Kids are under a lot of stress, and they're under our stress as well as their own. And it's compounded by a generation that is drawn, and I actually think they are led by unscrupulous businesses, into maladaptive modes of self-regulation. So they're either overstressed to begin with, or they're not restoring properly. They're doing maladaptive things. And the end result is a kid who's stuck in stress behavior and getting yelled at all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, number two, recognize. Okay, so first, refrain. Second, R, recognize. Recognize when this child is overstressed. And one really useful thing for parents to remember is, I can have, like, I've got a 17-year-old here at home. And when he's overstressed, he's a three-year-old. He's operating at a three-year-old's brain. And I can get confused about this. I can think to myself, well, he's 17 years old. You know, he's in grade 12. He should know. What he needs when he's overstressed is to come back to your default mode. I've got to get him back to 17. He needs soothing. He doesn't need a lecture. He doesn't need punishment. He needs to be calmed. And then what happens is something quite interesting. He starts to reframe himself. Okay, step number three, reduce the stress. So whatever the stresses are, I mean, you know, as a starting point, we say to parents, okay, the first thing we want to do is we want to clean up their room. We want a nice clean room, nice quiet room. We want to clean up their food. We do not want them eating junk food. We want them eating healthy. So we're going to reduce whatever stresses we can. Step number four, reflect. What that means is we've got a generation. We are seeing this now over and over. Kids who don't know what calmness is. Kids who have never experienced calmness. They confuse calmness with being distracted. So they can distract themselves with the game. They can distract themselves with a movie. But that's not calm. You're working very hard during these things. So we need them to actually experience, feel in their body what it's like to let the tension come down. You cannot calm a child down by telling them to calm down. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is the interesting one. The last R is restore. And restore means, now what we're going to look at is, what are you doing to keep your tank full? And obviously that refers to things like sleep hygiene and good diet. But it also refers to, what are you doing during the day that will restore? There isn't, as I said at the outset, there's not one way to do this. Mom and dad have to experiment. They have to find out what their kid loves. But trust me, if they find what's restorative, they will do it. Okay, so for my two children, for my son, he's a hockey player. Remember what Seth said at the outset, I'm a Canadian. So for him, restoring was shooting pucks at the garage door. Not so restorative for mom, but very restorative for him. For my daughter, it was painting. What we want is we want to build in these restorative activities so that we can wean them off of the maladaptive, wean them off the games. Not by telling them, no, you mustn't do this, but instead finding something that they enjoy more. If I had to give you my number one, I'd like to see them reading. Reading is very calming. Okay. You were supposed to remind me at the end. I think we're getting close to the end. So you're supposed supposed to remind me of something. Oh, you want to ask?
I remind you about COREG. Okay. I want, or maybe you can do these in either order, but one of the challenges I think with what you're saying is that I think that as adults, we are so dysregulated.
You're beating me to the punch.
We don't restore ourselves. We're in a culture that we're like, go, you know.
That was where I wanted to go.
Like, we can't stand in line anymore without being like checking our email in the line at the grocery store. We can't just be bored and calm and.
Okay, so Seth, so yes, you
so COREG in that.
Okay, well, you just answered it, but so here's the number one thing we do with every parent that we work with. They have to do self-reg for themselves first. So I would encourage them, we have lots of stuff for parents on our website that they can download for free. I want them to read the book. The book is about their own self-reg. Why is this so big? So Seth has used this term several times, co-regulation. And the reason is the following. I want to go back to the brain story I was telling, the triune brain. So we've got this middle brain, this red brain. And this red brain, it's not only is it constantly monitoring, it's also communicating. And it's communicating through our tone of voice, through our gestures, our facial expressions. If a parent comes in and they are themselves hyper-aroused, they are themselves overstressed, they are themselves agitated, it doesn't matter what they say. Their blue brain, they can have all the best words in the world, but their voice conveys to the child that they are agitated, that they are angry. When a child is in red brain, all they hear are these limbic utterances, these limbic communications. They don't hear the words. All they're processing is what mom or dad's limbic brain is saying, is communicating. So it's essential. And Seth is exactly right. We are all overstressed. And if we don't learn the five steps for our own well-being, we will find ourselves, Seth and I were talking about this just before we came on air, we will find ourselves in very heated, polarized political debates or social moral debates instead of being calm and socially constructive. But if our main concern is the well-being of our child, and that should be every parent's number one priority, I can't do any of the things that I've described today unless I am genuinely calm, unless I am myself in blue brain. And when I am, my kid picks it up. And it turns out that if I'm in blue brain, I don't really have to say very much. The child picks it up right away. The child feels safe and secure because the child is safe and secure.
Yeah, I will say that that's my secret to being able to successfully. So I talk about my work is to, you know, be able to lead a horse to water and make him drink. So I'm dealing with resistant students who are struggling to execute.
I love it.
And how do I do that? Well, the magic.
I love it.
Is the self-reg is that no, I'm that.
I just love it. I have nothing to say. That's just perfect. I love it.
Cool. So awesome. What specific action? So before I ask this, I should ask, is there any, what I'm going to ask you now is what actions can they take this week to implement what you're teaching? But is there anything that we left out before we go on to these final questions?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think we've covered the gist.
I think so. So what can parents do this week to start to implement some of your teachings?
So I'm going to give you a one sentence, a one word answer. And this is what we give parents at all of our, when we conclude any of our sessions with parents. So they always ask the same thing. How do I start? And the answer is, ask why. Why did he say that? Why did he do that? Why is she feeling this way? Why is this happening? Just asking why, what it does is it puts that pause in, so we don't react. We don't have that default mode that you called. But it also gets us just asking why, it gets us into that blue brain state where we are thinking, where we are processing, and our child picks all of that up. So that's what we're gonna leave them with today. If your child's doing something that you find, and trust me, I want parents to come away with this with the following. When you get a kid that can begin to shift into these growth promoting modes of self-regulation, that child's going to blow you away. That child is going to display all of a sudden talents and gifts, and we don't know what they are. We never know. But we do know one thing. That child is going to surprise you, is going to astonish you. And I have never, ever met a kid where this wasn't the case. So do you want a slogan to wrap it all up?
Yeah.
This is what we tell our parents. There is no such thing as a bad kid, ever. There is no such thing as a stupid kid, and there is no such thing as a lazy kid. But if we do the wrong things, if we treat stress behavior as if it was misbehavior, we can make them bad, lazy, or stupid. So what's our goal? I said it at the outset. I refuse to lose a kid. And I've seen it too many times now. I've seen it over and over. And I've seen, we were trying to do this just the other day, trying to figure out how many kids I've seen. Tens of 10,000s. I don't know how many kids I've seen. I never saw a bad kid, ever. Oh, I saw kids that were struggling. I saw kids that needed help. But every single time they received it, then I saw a kid that blew me away over and over. So that's our message.
Awesome. It's so aligned. I mean, a lot of why I do what I do is because when I went through that stuff as a young person, whether or not people said, Seth, you're bad or Seth, you're lazy, yeah, or whatever, I internalized
it. Of course, that's it.
And thought, Seth is bad. Seth is lazy. Seth's a failure.
That's it. That's it. Not too many kids can be like a Seth. Not too many kids. I don't know where you found the resources, but we have the knowledge now that this should never happen.
That's the thing. It wasn't easy. And that's why I do what I do, because they do not have to experience this.
No, they don't.
We do have these defaults that are maladaptive.
I agree. I couldn't agree more.
So thank you for the work that you do. And all the people here that are doing, there are so many.
Thank you for what you're doing. I love this summit.
Thanks. All right, you ready for the last question?
Okay, let me have it.
Look right in the camera, and from your heart to theirs, what is the most important takeaway? And I think you alluded to it already many times, but what is the most important takeaway that you hope parents leave with right this second?
Love your child. Okay? Love your child.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much. And we'll go ahead and stop the recording. Parents, go take action. Thank you. Take care.